සුඛී හොන්තු සාදු සාදු අනුමෝදාමි අනුමෝදි තබ්බං කමාමි කමි තබ්බං කමාමි කමි තබ්බං කේ වෙල්කම් everyone for the weekly discussion. So we are going along the Sutta Nipata in Kuddaka Nikaya Attaka Vagge and Paramattaka Sutta item we finished last time, so we are going to start the next one. And before going to the appointed sutta, conventional sutta, if anyone is having any interview reports or any comments or any suggestion, I cordially invite to present before starting the formal discussion. If anyone is having, we can give few seconds. Otherwise, we are invited to go to the conventional sutta. I cordially invite Venerable Buddha Rakhita to present the or proceed with the book.
Okay, before I start the sutta itself, I'll just try to give the background from the commentaries about the next sutta. So in this next sutta, the Buddha was spending the rains at Sawati, and then he was considering the reasons for making a tour into the countryside after the wasa, and whether it was conducive to his bodily health, whether it gave opportunity for the lay people for the laying down of new training rules or for taming people that could be guided, or when on a suitable occasion to relate a Jataka story and so on. So you can really see here that the Buddha considers very purposefully why he should go or do something. And this putting meaning at the foremost of any project is, I think this is something that we're beginning to see in some industries or governments or businesses where, you know, people say, well, what's the meaning of this? So it's not adequate enough to just say we're doing this for livelihood, or we're doing this to make some money, or we're doing this for the shareholders. Here you can see the Buddha puts meaning first before he does anything. So he decides that he's going to travel in stages to a town called Sakata and Sakita, and enters the Anjana Grove. And that's where he stays, and the people of the local town of Sakita, they decide to come the next morning, early the next morning, to offer gifts, flowers, incense, and so on to the Buddha, and invite the Buddha to come for alms in the city itself. So when the Buddha and the bhikkhus and the lay people return to the city, a couple, a Brahmin couple, the Brahmin sees the Buddha coming, and the Buddha informs the other bhikkhus to not hinder this Brahmin from approaching the Buddha or paying homage to the Buddha. So the Brahmin, it says here, he came like a cow attached to its calf. He embraced the Buddha's body all around, front and back, on the right and the left, saying, "It's been such a long time since I have seen you, son. We have been separated for so long." And similarly, when his wife comes and sees the Buddha, she says, "Our son has come." He says to his wife, "Our son has come, prepare a seat." She did so and stood awaiting the Buddha's arrival. And when she saw him along the road, there arose a great affection of a mother for her son, and she grabbed the Blessed One by his feet, weeping, "It's been such a long time since I have seen you, my son." So later the Buddha was asked by Ananda what his relationship was with these people, and he said, "Ananda, in 500 consecutive previous births, this Brahmin and his wife were my father and mother. in 500 past births, they were my elder aunt and uncle. And in 500 past births, they were my junior aunt and uncle. They speak with reference to this past affection. So then the Buddha says one of these Dhammapada verses, because of previous dwelling together or a present benefit, affection arises for someone as a lily is born in water. And then having stayed in Sakita as long as he wished, the Blessed One continued his journey, returning to Sawati. And the Brahmin and wife continued to approach the bhikkhus, heard suitable Dhamma teachings and reached the remaining paths and attained final Nibbana by the Nibbana element without residue remaining. So the Brahmins in the city assembled and said, let us honor our relatives. This is when they had passed on. So their followers, who were lay people, but they were stream enterers, once returners and non-returners, they also assembled to honor the passing of these elder people, this elder couple. And they did so by forming a briar to burn their corpses. And as the night came to the end, the Buddha, while surveying the world, knew that the couple had attained final Nibbana. And he realized, when I have gone there, people will hear my Dhamma teachings and many will make the breakthrough to the Dhamma. So he took his bowl and outer robe and he again left Sawati and entered the cremation ground where this couple were being cremated. And the Blessed One has come wishing to honor the bodily remains of his mother and father. That's what the people said. They venerated him and stood there. And having venerated at that briar, having brought it to the cremation ground, the citizens asked the Buddha how should the householder noble disciples be venerated. So then the Buddha said that they should be venerated in the same way that arahants are venerated. And with that intention, he spoke this verse, showing that they had become arahant munis. Those munis who are harmless ones, always restrained by the body, go to the imperishable state where having gone, one does not sorrow. This is Dhammapada verse 225. So this was the background to this longer sutta that we're going to discuss today. So this is entitled Jara Sutta, or on Old Age. So the first verse goes, short, alas, is this life. One even dies before 100 years. Even if one lives longer, one still dies because of old age. People sorrow over things taken as mine, for there are no permanent possessions. Having seen that there is separation, one should not live the home life. And then the third verse, whatever a person conceives thus, this is mine, that too is abandoned at death. Having understood this, a wise one, my follower, should not incline to take things as mine. So this sutta focuses on death, and on the occasion of a funeral, and on the occasion of passing of two celebrated elderly couple. So even though they lived a long and a prosperous life, the Buddha reminds people that life is short. So as when I was young, it felt like every day was long. And I would ask my parents, when will I grow up? When will I be big? And I remember this old man who used to look after me when I was a child, he liked to grow trees, and we would collect the nut or the seed of a tree, and we would plant it and put it in a pot and take care of it for the first few years while it was still a very tender sapling of a tree. And then we would find a suitable location and we would plant the tree. He particularly liked oak trees. And I remember as a young child asking him, you know, when will the tree be big? And I remember him trying to explain to me that it will take a long time for this tree to grow big. And outside of his house, there was a very large oak tree, and it was a few hundred years old. It was one of the oldest trees in our area. And, you know, but as I get older, I see that every day is getting shorter and shorter. And every week is shorter and shorter, and every month is shorter and shorter, and every year is shorter and shorter. So this statement, short, alas, is this life. One even dies before 100 years. Even if one lives longer, one still dies because of old age. So there are many reasons, as I've experienced in life, many causes or reasons for death. You know, death by accident, death by mischief, death by suicide, death by disease. But no matter what happens, there's always death by old age. You know, one thing or another, you can have perfect health or excellent health or excellent health care all the way through your life. I knew somebody who lived to be 90 years of age and they had never been in hospital. Never once in hospital. And, you know, quite remarkably good health. But they too died of old age. So we have to keep this reality in life. And, you know, as the Buddha began his journey to visit the city, he reviewed carefully the meaning and the purpose of his visit. So the purpose, in a way, of contemplation of death is to bring an imperative into our life, to bring to assist any meaning and purpose. So when we look at our life, we sometimes need to think, what am I doing with my life? And then we need to think, okay, what am I doing each day with my life? In Australia, they have a nice expression, have legs, can walk. Well, you know, if you have legs, you can walk, meaning you can make a journey. But you need a life. So if you have a day, you can live a life. And many monks have this practice of reflecting before they go to sleep, that this is the end of the day and this is the end of their life. And then when they wake up in the morning, they reflect, okay, this is a new day and this is the beginning of a new life. In a way, to just bring about this imperative and sense that life is short and we should use it meaningfully and with purpose. And this practice of death contemplation, I've noticed it widely. It comes up in various forms around the world these days, you know, where people use this practice of, for instance, writing their own memorial. Like, how would I like to be looked upon? You know, how would I like people to regard my life? Was it a useful life or a not so useful life? Did I help others, or did I expect others to always have to help me? You know, what was my legacy? And this practice is very ancient. It goes back even to the Greeks, and they have a word for it, and they call it eudaimonia. So when somebody would die, then they would kind of assess that person's life, and they would start to say whether that person had lived a valuable life or not, or a heroic life or not. And if we look at the Greek poetry, you know, you see these great celebrations of the life of the great heroes. So this was their practice, was to not really say whether somebody had lived a great life while they were living, but only really when they had passed away that they would assess that person's life. So these days we like to assess our life as, like, I live in this house, I live in this area, my kids go to this school. You know, I have this position in a company. You know, I'm this kind of a person. I'm so that you can say that this is assessing their life. So from the ancient Greeks' point of view, this is not considered like how you do it. You can only really assess somebody basically at the end of their life, how they've lived a full life, and if again that life was a life with with meaning, then it was a valuable life. And if it had no meaning, then it wasn't a valuable life. So they didn't rate or they didn't value like somebody who just led a hedonic life. So hedonic is just sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You know, sense gratification, just indulgence. Like this wasn't in the ancient Greeks, like standards. That wasn't considered living a valuable life or a high life. It was just gratification. So sometimes I meet people and they tell me that they're busy, for instance. And then I ask, well, what are you busy with? Oh, I need to prepare some food to eat. I'm busy. Or I need to go and eat. I'm busy, you know. Or I need to look after my children. I'm busy. And actually, all of these things are duties. You know, I need to eat is a duty. And I need to look after my children is a duty. It's not, in some ways, it's not special. Like if you neglect to do this kind of thing, then you will be criticized. But if you do it, it's just performing your duty. It's not above and beyond the call of duty. It's, in a way, it's not special, in a sense. Well, of course, you know, the devas and everybody really have a good regard for the good parents who do their duties well. I'm just saying when somebody is just passing the mark, it's not considered anything heroic about it. So life is short and one even dies before 100 years. So this is a profound statement of truth, of reality. And it can be very, from my point of view, it can be very vacuous or empty how people seem to not consider death, and you know, the discussion of death is considered like a bad conversation. Whereas I find it very meaningful, and many of my most enjoyable conversations have been with, like for instance, very old people in their 80s, in their 90s, and asking them about their life, and asking them how they got through difficult times, and asking them about what was meaningful for them, what was valuable to them at that age. And you can see that in many people who live a long life, that they have a youthfulness to them. They're still interested in people. They're interested in what's going on around them. They're willing to make change. You know, they're willing to learn new habits. Whereas people like who are not enjoying old age are grumbling. They're complaining. They're finding it difficult to adapt to the changes in their life and their circumstances. As one of them told me, one old lady told me, she said that her sisters who didn't meditate, they just were watching television all the time and were too involved in their family affairs, in their kids and in their grandkids. Whereas she was somebody who spent her time at retreat centers, even though she was in her 80s. And she was very active, and she had given up her properties to her children, and had, you know, she would drop in, you know, occasionally across the year to visit them, spend a little time with them. But she wasn't sort of engaged in their life very much. And I asked her very carefully about these kind of things, and she said that, you know, she cared about her family, but she wasn't engrossed into her family's life, and she wasn't engaged in frivolous conversation and reminiscing about the past. She was very much in the present and engaged in the activities in this retreat center where I was staying. So it was very inspiring to meet a person who was living a very purposeful life. So the second verse says that people sorrow over things that are taken as mine, for there are no permanent possessions. Having seen that there is separation, one should not live the home life. So again, the Buddha gets down to the crux of the matter, which is this sense of atta, or this conceit that that this is mine. So even our body, our faculties, all of these things are not mine. They are what we call aggregates or sankhara, and they will go their own way in due course. So they're not permanent possessions, they're just temporary possessions. And our relationship with our blood family, with our clan, with our neighborhood, with our country is not a permanent possession, but a temporary possession. So for people listening, many of you are migrants and living overseas, you can reflect on your own experience. When you go around saying to people, I am Sri Lankan or something like that, what does that mean? If you haven't lived in Sri Lanka for the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years, what does it mean to say I am a Sri Lankan? Or you've lived more than half of your life outside of the country that you were born in. You know, your country is not a permanent possession, you know. So your children are not permanent possessions. They're going to grow up and leave and, get on with their own life. Or your children are growing up overseas in Australia, and you say, I am Sri Lankan, and they say, I am Australian. So what does it mean? Well, people sorrow over things taken as mine, for there are no permanent possessions. So this is what the Buddha is saying here. So you can reflect on your own life and whether this statement has any truth in your life. And having seen that there is separation, one should not live the home life. So if you really see that you will be separated from everything you consider your possession, like I am Sri Lankan, these are my children, this is my house, this is my livelihood, this is my health, and you will be separated from all of that, then this imperative was the same imperative that even the Buddha Gautama required as the Bodhisattva, Gautama, he required to see that the person aging, sick and dead, to give him the impetus, the stimulus to seek out, to leave the home life and to enter into the homeless. So I've been talking a while, so maybe I should give and listen to what Mahatero has to say about this.
Thank you. So at the beginning you mentioned about the Nidana, whereby how Buddha is reflecting about before going to the trip and kind of thing. It can be just a fabrication of the commentators, because after finishing you can write a good Nidana. And commentators, that is my criticism, this is the Buddha did everything after contemplating what is going to happen and all the kind of thing, and it appears like a very nice fabrication, nice storytelling, and that is what the gods emergence and everything is like, something perfect, pedantic. And Zen stories also, the fabrication is very beautiful, that is mystical. So commentators are taking the chance, and after the event they give their interpretation in order to justify their views. Ultimately, when you are accepting what the Buddha mentioned and what the commentator mentioned, there is a hidden curriculum in the commentary. But of course, this is informative. That we can't. This, because otherwise you are clueless. But always they give their Buddhist, Buddha is the best. And of course, it is a truth. I believe as a monk. But the way it is fabricating, we become religious. We become ism. And not something we have to verify. We have to not only accept the Buddha, we have to accept the commentary. Specifically, Burmese system. They say, don't read what the Buddha says. First read commentary and learn how to read what the Buddha is telling. Like Protestant Buddhism, they can't read Bible. Only the father has to read and they have to follow. I don't know, Pentecostal maybe. So likewise, keep in this thing. So when I read the Sutta Pitaka, basically Majjhima Nikaya, that is what the Venerable Jnanarama says, read as much as possible. I say, I don't understand. So you can see other side is single commentary. So you can read 30-40%, you can understand by again and again, you see the disparity. But it's the truth in the Pali, we believe that is as the Buddha word, specifically in the Sutta Nipata, and undeclinable. And then commentary is completely a story. I mean, it is good to have the commentary, the Nidana, but it's a fabrication. Book writers, they know, they write the introduction of the book after writing the book. Name of the book is after writing the book. They are not writing on a theme. They just write and last decide how to introduce this and what must be the title page. So likewise, our story also, we are just living. And ultimately we find our view, our mental thinking and verbs and deeds and livelihood, everything is, we try to put into a cage and the formulas and say, he is so-and-so, he is so-and-so, he is existentialist, he is a nihilist, he is a eternalist. But there is no such thing. And things are changing. So therefore we have to keep due place about this Nidana and storytelling. Ultimately you will be overcome by the papancha or this storytelling, and basic what the ideas will be glossed over. The term jara is translated as old age, but in singular meaning it is perished or dirty, not beautiful, jara. But the term came diranama. Dirana means from the day birth, its maturing happened. But jaravinama, that house is well kept, we call good housekeeping. But the house is messed up, it's called jara karla. That means jara, that is messy. So therefore, it is a characteristic of elderly people, traditional. But we, Sri Lankan, I was amazed to see old age of the white people. They are living in a calm and quiet, they are neat. And they are spending, either getting attendant or they wanted to have the... But if you take a traditional person, they are living with a very little amount and they are dirty, they are not taking a bath and all the kinds of... So that jara is a something organic for us, not the old age. But now I can understand even the white or black, whatever it may be, their commanding power of the life is reducing. And those who do not know or do not care, ajnanupeksha, they just succumb to the time. But the person who is having organized life, he knows at the old age I have to have some kind of a support, the insurance or palliation, palliate support and all the kind of thing. But in a traditional way, in our societies, they just allow it to happen. So by looking at, you can tell how old he is. No makeup, no costumes, just living. So therefore, jara itself, definitely I agree that is basic with the intrinsic factor is old age. When the old is happening, time passes very slow, everything is slowed down. And at that time, hardly any person can have a good memory. Whenever I remember the past, it's bad. Regret. The whole old age, in Western language, after getting pension, you have another psychological shock. Because what to do? Your value gone. And the youngsters are running the show. So, but the Eastern society, beard, long beard and the white hair people are respected. But those who do not know the art of living, they deteriorate and they can't come to the society and they don't have enough clothing and shelter and kind of thing. But there are some. So Brahmins mention that we are well-organized plan, and more the Brahmin family become, people become older, they become more venerated and respected. But the other professionals, caste, they become jara. But the word meaning is from the day you birth, the deterioration start. And the other thing is the story about, Greek story about comment someone upon the, after the death, is being mentioned to me. Avaloku Hamduru, one day when I am coming, this is the place I am sitting now, I come, I can see through the window, he is doing something, seriously doing something. So I came to the library was this room. I came and observed, no one is there. He's organizing something and packing something and kind of thing. And ultimately he went there with the shaky hand, lifted the Buddha statue, or preparation the seat and kind of thing. He wanted to bring it and keep it on that. Just like a children make a playhouse. So I jumped into and I told Manti, may I help you to take this statue? He was shocked to see that I came, intruded into that. And he says, no, without you I can manage. That is what I did. I just wanted to make some handkerchiefs and make a nice sitting place for the Buddha and keep in the statue. Then I told, I can't understand you being such an old fellow. Well, meditate, why you are doing all the ritualistic thing on the Buddha? I expect you to have a mindfulness and all the kind of thing, but instead you are doing ritualistic thing. Well, no harm. He says, not that the thing we are doing is going to decide who am I, we are who we are. After the death, what is the role model left is the only matter. Not your winning or losing, what you are doing meaningful, it's useless. After the death, what is the message you are leaving behind? That is important. See, naturally, in my age, 36, 37, so I have no idea about the death. I am living, I am making my career, and I have to win everything, hedonic. And he says, no problem, you can carry on. But I am concerned, what will be the memory I am leaving behind, that is most important. So everyone knows about Velama Jnanarama is having a good memory. His impact was never immediately to that particular moment, but lasting. Good smell. He's master. And next I found Supandita Saido. He don't care the meeting with the person and kind of thing. He says, I am a Theravada, Mahathera. This is what I am doing. If you like, you can. Otherwise, you go. Never mind. But other people are carried away by the immediate benefits and the cost and all the kind of thing. Ultimately, they will carried away by the social norms, social waves. They have no character. They don't have backbone. But the Theravada is giving. But joke is, maybe 10 years ago, the founder of this place, his relatives presented his name as the National Heroes List. Asoka Viranatha and later the Dhammanisanti. And they give the condition, the committee selecting the national heroes, they give this must be the qualification to be considered, just like Nobel Prize candidates. First thing, he must be dead by now. If you wish to be a national hero, you must make sure you are dead. Because while you are living, if given honorary this thing, and if they are, after that, if you're going to do a dirty thing, company also finished, committee also finished, everything. So first and foremost, so what a joke. What a joke. Whole world, not the present moment, but after the death. I mean, it's good because it is a cumulative effect, not the individual kind of thing. But when you are considering and comparing it with sati, each and every moment, the arising is happening and changes happening and passing away, even in the old age or in the womb, as the embryo, things are happening. That make no impact to the whole system. But each and every cell, each and every organ, each and every person going to make, I am specific, I am superior. I have to make history. I have to make marks, bookkeeping, and keeping journals. So ultimately you dissolve into the normal air element and the earth element and kind of thing, you become no one. But instead, if you are going to make highlighted, I am one-upmanship and all the kind of thing, what a kind of a friction. And if you are just living like a tree in the forest, and then understanding you started with the earth element, air element and kind of thing, end up with that kind of thing. Other people also the same. your idea will not be accepted in this competitive world. So therefore, jara, from the time of conception, the deterioration starts. It is obvious after 50s. That is the psychological rebirth for a person to understand. By 50s, you have done all your dirty things and youthful thing and radical thing and everything. But everything becomes null and void. At least early signs are there because your eyes become deteriorated. The ear sensitivity deteriorates. Your facial expression and the youth deterioration. And then onward, for what you are living. That is the aim of life, not the aim of the present moment. So, when it is reduced to the present moment, birth and the death is become equal, you and me become equal. Everything is insignificant in the vast system, but then we can't develop any egotistic kind of evaluation. But Buddha is completely not thinking about the system approach. He is giving some kind of a value for the role models to these two parents. He says they become affectionate, but usually lay people don't touch monk's body, specifically female. But this lady, come and touch my son. Then Yasodhara, after the 7 years of return, come and hug into the legs and cry to wash the whole below the knees get wet. And the King Suddhodana says, it is not done. He's a recluse. Then the Buddha says, don't do it. She will get a heart attack. Let it happen. But we, Upasampada monks, must not be allowed anyone to touch the feet. Males, never mind. But females, some people, they want to get the blessings, they touch. While you are sitting and while offering something under the desk, they come and touch. So I don't know if it is a hedonic kind of a thing or affectionate kind of thing or kind of getting a blessings. So these things also accepted, even though we are considering the system approach, they are there. So aesthetic value, the moral shame and the moral fear, and the absolute values, the Buddha make a soup, make a cocktail, make a salad of everything. Not completely cut out the social values and the individual value, no. Not completely embracing the system value, no. He says, balance it in such a way, and he lived 45 years as a beggar, disguised, a king disguised as a beggar, lived in such a beautiful life, and expressions and giving examples still reverberating, and we can see not theory fabrication. He lived and set the Sangha community and set the role models, Venerable Sariputta, Moggallana and kind of thing. And we are also experiencing the same, just like butterflies, just like birds. We are living on earth. Role models are there. We know, sometimes we may extrapolate to the future monks will be more deteriorated, more chasing behind the fame, gain and kind of thing. But to our age, I think we are very lucky people. We are fairly rejuvenated. We are day by day, we are, of course, when you are reading this kind of thing, can understand even the world deteriorated, even the world run by fools, individuals can find solace by mindfulness. Upandita Sayadaw used to say, our eyes, as well as our spiritual life to say, is smeared by the grease and the rust, and the outer crust is such a, how to call it, defilements, but gathered outside. They happen aeons of time. The outer crust is rust, but by one moment of mindfulness, you can cut through and see inner glory. You can see inner brightness by cutting through this outer painting, outer rust, outer grease layer. So therefore, one moment of mindfulness is giving a balance of the individual or reductionist and the systematic system approach, but both of them are not leading to Nibbana. You have to understand sansaric point of view and the present moment point of view. Present moment is santara, sansara is a present moment. That is what Nagarjuna wrote in the Mulli Madhyama Karika. If you understand the whole sansara, you are in Nibbana. Not getting rid of sansara. Understanding sansara. So Theravada do not accept it. It says, no, don't talk about sansara. Leave aside. You go to the forest and sit under a tree, cross-legged, closed eyes, Nibbana. So these two, individually we are, each of us, bridging each other. We have our own family, our own relationships and our day-to-day life, and we have our secluded moment. But life means connecting both. So jati, jara, vyadhi, marana, four things the Buddha mentioned, sansara roga, rebirth, old age, sickness and the death. All considered as not belongs to this life. And the youngsters, they don't like, they don't wish to see the childbirth. They are not happy to see old age people. They don't happy to go to the hospitals and where the sick people. And they don't go to the funerals. They want to have Valentine's Day. You know, the lover's lane. And the fancy houses. And they are making the life. But we being monks, of course, before becoming monk, we also had our lay life. There we can understand that it's just entertainment. Hedonic, I think, is a good term. But instead, we are using Vedana Anupassana, see the feelings in order to understand the feeling, not to carry it away by the feeling. So therefore, this Jara Sutta is usually applicable to the and attractive to the people, those who have self-mortification type. They are very happy with this kind of sutta. Vijay Sutta, Jara Sutta, they are. But those who are in the sexual indulgence, they don't like it. They like quick enlightenment, satori, sin stories. So therefore, the Sutta Nipata, few suttas are there. Deep go into the jati, jara, vyadi, marana. But it does not indicate any kind of a self-mortification, the truth of the life. So therefore, we have to read it. And if someone is not happy with this kind of sutta, that means they are always happy to have the beautiful thing, lovable things, and the eternalism. But some people very happy with that. They have elements of self-mortification. So in that sense, Jara Sutta is, even though it is related to that historical event, the Buddha indicates how to make use to develop a great urge to be in the present moment. And I think that is the gist of the idea, to make a point not to worry about the past or future, but to be in the present is always relative. It is not absolute. You have to know past and the future. Without that, no present moment. So when you are introducing mindfulness, to always understand the regret about the past and the excitement about the future. Without that, you can't understand. So therefore, this is basically about the past life you lived. Old age indicates a very good indication. That is my view, expression.
So again, going on to the third verse, which I had read out earlier on, whatever a person conceives thus, this is mine, that too is abandoned at death. having understood this, a wise one, my follower, should not incline to take things as mine. So again, the Chinese have a nice expression, you can give it a cold hand or you can give it a warm hand. So the idea is that you can have generosity in life or you can have generosity with death. So that's the giving with the cold hand is generosity with death. So it doesn't really matter whether you want to give or not give, you can't hold on to it after you die. So this idea, of death is very important, that death is going to bookend your life. So you have birth and you have death. And again, in Western culture, there's a great emphasis given on birth, that birth is wonderful and that death is a tragedy. However, from a Buddhist point of view, actually, birth can be the tragedy and death is the salvation in some ways. Like in this case, the couple that have died have attained parinibbana, so they have completely finished their rounds of existence. They have put an end to suffering, whereas birth is not an end to suffering, it's the start of that life's suffering itself. And this suffering is intensified by the thought that this is mine. So this mine is again referring back to the first and second noble truths, that there is suffering and it is arising because of craving. And one of the key elements of craving is that we take the idea or the perception that this is mine. And even so, whatever you conceive as mine, you have to abandon at death, whether it's with a warm hand or a cold hand, you will abandon it. Having understood this, a wise one, my follower, should not incline to take things as mine. So again, like once we start to take on something as mine, then we kind of make it our property, or we, as we were mentioning in previous talks, we sort of nest. We get very nested into things. We get nested into our house, into our possessions. We get nested into our family, and this is the way we expect things to happen. And we get very nested into our habits and our behaviors. Our bugs become features, our different qualities, our different characters are built on these habits that have developed over a lifetime. So we say, this is mine, this is my way of doing things. And, having understood this, a wise one should not incline to take things as mine. So in a way, we learn to hold on to things much more lightly. And it's quite nice. I notice myself, like as a migrant, like who has lived more than half his life overseas, I don't have to hold on to any identity anymore. And that's a great relief. I can just be myself and be myself in this present moment as I am. I don't have to be like a broken record repeating myself and the same sets of thoughts, habits and behaviors all the time that we compound into character. And sometimes when I meet old friends, like I wonder why are you still behaving the same way? why do you have to keep going like that? Why not try something new? So again, I find with these very old people, they're willing to try something new, whereas those older people who are not really thriving in a way, they're like broken records and just stuck in the past and stuck in past behaviors and so on. So just as on awakening, a person does not see whatever was encountered in a dream, so too one does not see a beloved person who has died and passed away. Just as on awakening, a person does not see whatever was encountered in a dream. So we can see that it is this mirage, this false perception that we have. We take something as real when it's not real at all. And when we open our eyes, we realize it's not real or it's not true. So when we dream, the dream can be incredibly vivid and realistic. And we are immersed into that dream. And then when we wake up from that dream, that whole thing has completely disappeared. So just as on awakening, and in this awakening too, we are enlightened in this spiritual path. So once one is enlightened, then the dream or the delusionary qualities of the world pass away. We start to see things as they really are. So too, one does not see a beloved person who has died and passed away. You know, once one has died, once a beloved person has died, we don't see them anymore. So they become a dream in a sense. They no longer exist. They have become a dream. Whereas, you know, we sometimes we fail to see that too. You know, we hold on to the memory of somebody, whereas the reality is that they have passed away. Although those people have seen and heard and were known by such and such a name, when a person has passed away, the name alone remains to be uttered. So here, like when somebody has died, we'll just say mother or father, they have died. Then all that's left of them is their name. So we refer to my mother, my father, but in reality, they have passed away. So again, the Buddha is really bringing home the point that once one has died, there is nothing remaining of that person, of that set of aggregates of that time, of that place. I mean, of course, as Buddhists, we believe that somebody has been reborn again. But the even that reborn person is similar to their previous personage, but not the same. And I think about the 14th Dalai Lama. So the current Dalai Lama is the 14th Dalai Lama, which means the 14th time that he has taken rebirth as this Dalai Lama. And so if we look at pictures of the 13th Dalai Lama and the 14th Dalai Lama, they're different people, in physically different, but they have similar habits or interests, or at least they had. For instance, when they went searching for the 14th Dalai Lama, you know, he was able to identify personal objects of the 13th Dalai Lama. So apparently the 13th Dalai Lama quite liked watches, and so does the 14th Dalai Lama. If you notice in the Rolex ads, you see these Rolex ads of the 14th Dalai Lama. So the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama is quite interested in science, and so was the 13th Dalai Lama. So they have similar, some similar characteristics and traits, but they're not the same person. So although those persons have been seen and heard and were known by such and such a name, when a person passes away, the name alone remains to be uttered. So it's quite a phenomena. It's quite paradoxical that somebody can be the 13th and the 14th Dalai Lama as such. There's a continuity of consciousness between those between that person or that personage or that Dalai Lama, but they're not the same person at the same time. So that maybe that's where I can stop for a while and.
Yes, it's time up, and you mentioned about the dreaming, you mentioned about the paradoxical situation, and that I think Carl Jung tried to explain in the Western way, and the Lao Tzu mentioned in the Chinese way about the dreaming, and Carl Jung also tried to see dream-wise we are the same, or whatever the culture. Our meanings, expressions are the same. So it indicates kind of a vast knowledge. This is not relevant to the day-to-day life and something not verifiable and not scientific. And then many people say it is old age or gone the past knowledge. But the psychiatry opening some kind of an into this thing, because people get mad and there is no reason. And then only thing is by referring to the future or past, specifically the regression, and they can give the answer. And just not by any medicine, but just understanding the cause is not present, not the same person, but kind of a relationship. So that is the point where the science is losing And therefore now science is coining the words like mind science. And when the mind science happens, they have to go to Africa, they have to go to Asia, but there were the place people had that heritage. But when the civilization, everything happened, all these wizards and all people being killed. And only rational thing came as science. Now science is killing science. So we have to go. But we being in the present moment, we take it as fabrication. We take it as something relevant. But either you believe or not, no harm. The past or future or dreams on the reality. So whenever Jnananda reduce it to the concept and reality. Now we are meditating, we have concepts. Sometimes we are worried about. But ultimately you know it's a concept. But whenever you are worrying, concept become reality. If you are not worrying, concept become concept. So that is how the papancha, mental proliferation, going to shape up your body, shape up your thinking. So if you know, it's a mind-made, it's a fabrication, it is a proliferation. Only when you understand the mindful mind, and then you can understand this prolific mind or storytelling mind. And now the storytelling and fabrication become a very famous, very attractive thing in quantum physics. This is a fabrication. It's a big game theory. And storytelling. So whole literature is nothing but a storytelling. So we are going to stop at that level. That means we have stopped, come up to the 810 stanzas. And next time we will start with 811. Thank you very much for the participation and for the selection of this sutta. Kama kamitabhaṁ sukhi hotu, sukhi hotu.